Bienvenidos. This is a podcast that explores Latinx media and culture in its many forms. I am Dr. Rojo Robles.
And I am Dr. Rebecca L. Salois. And we are Latinx and Latin American Studies professors at Baruch College in New York City. In this podcast, we will analyze Latinx film, television, literature, art, and cultures.
We will consider how these works are perceived, analyze them, and investigate the real-world reflections and implications of that work on Latinx cultures in the U.S. and beyond.
Welcome to Latinx Visions.
Bienvenidas, bienvenides, bienvenidos.
Welcome back, everyone.
Today, we're in conversation with Olivia Juarez and Val Scholl from Green Latinos. Green Latinos is a national nonprofit organization that brings together Latina leaders committed to addressing environmental and conservation issues that affect the well-being of Latina communities in the U.S. This interview was recorded on Friday, April 5th via Zoom.
And as a disclaimer for that, Olivia's audio is a little bit wonky because she wasn't in a stable location, and we do lose them in the end, but we're glad for the answers they were able to contribute. Before we get to the interview, we're going to share some background information on Green Latinos, including the organization's vision and mission, and brief bios on our two guests. After the interview, we'll return to share our thoughts and key takeaways from the conversation.
From their website, Green Latinos is an active comunidad of Latino, Latina, Latina leaders emboldened by the power and wisdom of our culture, united to demand equity and dismantle racism, resourced to win our environmental conservation and climate justice battle, and driven to secure our political, economic, cultural, and environmental liberation.
Green Latinos provides an inclusive table at which its members establish collaborative partnerships and networks to improve the environment, protect and promote the conservation of land and other natural resources, amplify the voices of minority, low-income, and tribal communities, and train, mentor, and promote the current and future generations of Latino environmental leaders to benefit the Latino community and beyond. Green Latinos develops and advocates for policies and programs to advance this mission.
According to their stated vision, they envision a healthy and equitable society where communities of colors are liberated from disproportionate environmental burdens, free to breathe fresh air, drink pure water, access clean transportation, and enjoy our majestic public lands, oceans, and waters. Today, we're speaking with two of the organization's directors, Olivia Juarez, Public Land Director, and Val Scholl, Water Equity and Ocean Program Director.
Olivia Juarez has lived their whole life in Utah and is currently based in Salt Lake City. They earned an Honors Peace and Conflict Studies degree from the University of Utah. They enjoy camping, loud music, playing in the snow, bicycling, yoga, and gazing at cryptobiotic soils, which I was like, a what? And apparently that is soil that hides life. So there we go. We learned something. In addition to their work as the public land director for Green Latinos, Olivia has also worked with Latino Outdoors, the Utah Coalition of La Raza, and the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. This work has allowed them to cultivate Latinx joy and leadership in conserving nuestra tierra pública. Those are their words. In 2021, the National Parks Conservation Association recognized Olivia as one of 10 under 40 for their commitment to creating safe, equitable access to public lands for Latino community health.
Val Scholl is a first-generation Chicana raised in the Valle de San Joaquin in California. They earned a BS in Biological Engineering and Natural Resources from Cornell University and an MS and PhD in Agricultural Engineering from Purdue University. They enjoy gardening, powerlifting, and listening to podcasts and audiobooks. As the Water Equity and Ocean Program Director at Green Latinos, they advocate for policies that champion equitable access to and conservation of freshwater and saltwater systems. Their interest in water systems stems from growing up in a farm worker comunidad near the San Joaquin River.
We're excited to have both of them, or one and a half of them, with us here today on the episode as we wrap up our season on climate activism.
Olivia, Hola Olivia, hola Val, bienvenidos al podcast Latin Expeditions. We look forward to chatting with you today about public lands, oceans, and the Latinx community. How are you?
Gracias, I'm doing well. Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Just to start us off, could you both tell us maybe a little bit about how you became involved in Green Latinos and your current roles in the organization?
Sure, I'll jump in. Thank you. Green Latinos is nationwide, wherever our community of environmental conservation and climate justice champions are, that's where Green Latinos is. And I first got connected as a organizer for conserving Red Rock Wilderness throughout the state of Utah. I was hired by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance to increase and just foster Latino community support for protecting public lands. And, you know, what took me there and what connected me to public lands in the first place was the campaign to conserve Bears Ears National Monument in 2015, when I heard of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition and their proposal for co-management of the monument. I thought for the first time, here's justice and climate and honoring the environment all happening in one place. So that took me to public land advocacy. Dua encouraged me early on joining that organization as an organizer to get connected with Green Latinos. And so during that time, I was an active Green Latinos member and got recruited after some years to join as the public land program director.
Awesome.
I can go next. In terms of how I ended up getting involved with Green Latinos, it starts back in terms of like where I grew up. I grew up in a small farm worker community in the Central Valley of California, and I grew up right next to the San Joaquin River. And so being in that community that's so heavily reliant in terms of like the natural systems, and in California, because of the way that the hydrology works, where there's most of the water that's going into the Central Valley actually comes from the Sierra Nevadas and is actually snowmelt. And that's how a lot of the water comes in to the valley. It really captured my interest in hydrology and also water resources management, but it also brought together, and at the time I didn't have the jargon forward, these environmental justice issues, particularly when it came to my community. You know, farm workers are very reliant in having in farms being able to have access to water, but there was also inequities when it came to drinking water. And so I left the Central Valley for school. I ended up going out to the East Coast and went to school at Cornell, where I majored in biological engineering with the focus of bioenvironmental. It was like a revamp of their agricultural engineering department, and then also in natural resources. And then I continued on to get my master's and PhD at Purdue University in the Midwest, really interested in seeing how that hydrology changes, because when I went out east, the hydrology was so different. And I was like, there's so much water here. And then in the Midwest, it was also very different in terms because of the topography. And so I was really intrigued in terms of like how these agricultural systems are managed, but also like who the stakeholders were. And oftentimes what I noticed was that the Latino community and the farm worker communities were often left out of these conversations. And a lot of these conversations always came back to water. And so then after I graduated from my doctoral work, I went to became a postdoctoral researcher at the New York State Water Resources Institute, where I continued to look in terms of applied science. And that was like my first more policy focus role in terms of working within this institute. Every state has a water research institute, as they're all based in their land grant universities. And from there, I was able to see an opening for the Water Equity and Ocean Program Director role that tied in a lot of this like focus of understanding how to do communication work, which is some of the work that kind of tied it into my research of making sure to be able to develop tools that helped policy and decision makers better understand the complexities of water data and water resources management, as well as being able to tie in that connecting point of like what got me interested in research and understanding hydrology and water resources management in the first place, which was, you know, being able to work with community organizations as well as individuals who also, you know, are strong environmental advocates. And one of the roles that I really appreciated about, you know, the background was that we did try to work across various sectors, and Green Latinos, you know, being a community of environmental advocates that tries to reach academics, people in the nonprofit sector, and, you know, environmental professionals, like it really brought forth these ideas that I was really passionate about. And so I ended up getting the position, which I was really excited about. And I've also gotten to learn more about ocean justice and ocean work, which hasn't been my background, but it's been very exciting to be able to continue to be curious, which I think ties into some of that research. And we've also been really pushing in terms of building out our research agenda. So it provides an opportunity for me to be able to continue to pursue that as well.
The great combination of the two, like bringing those two worlds together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Olivia, this is a question for you, but you can both speak to it in as much as the subjects, of course, overlap. So how does the climate crisis distinctly affect members of Latinx communities in the U.S., explicitly concerning public land access and conservation?
Oh, thank you. What a great question. I first want to acknowledge that every aspect of our world, whether it's because of extraction from fossil fuels that's happening on public lands or private lands, or the built environments that we live in their own ways, but also in the same way, distinctly harming Hispanics and Latinos, mainly. And one sort of way that our comunidades are distinctly harmed is because of the kinds of jobs that we hold. Latinos and Hispanics disproportionately hold outdoor jobs in construction and cleaning, in an outdoor-based workforce. And due to the fact that we are a huge force in outdoor jobs, keeps catastrophic deadly heat waves even, or when wildfire smoke is filling the air, and outdoor workers are dying because they are outside in the elements, dealing with the unbearable impacts of the climate crisis. And those impacts are coming from public land. 25% of all the greenhouse gas emissions that come from the United States come from public lands and waters, from the natural gas that is extracted across our deserts, from the oil that is taken from the oceans. And that's a really significant chunk of the U.S.'s emissions. If you took U.S. public lands and waters, you made them their own country, and you compared the U.S. nation of public lands and waters emissions to other countries, we would be something like number five behind the other four top big polluters. And so we're extracting everywhere, but, you know, public lands, more than anything, it's nature. It's our rivers, it's valleys and canyon lands that can be solving the climate crisis and this problem of excess pollution, not contributing to it. And what we need are these solutions. We need the carbon that's been released in the air to be sequestered back into the earth. We need all of the water that's being dropped and moved in the water cycle around the earth just to be treated, and as well as the earth would have it, with healthy ecosystem services. And public lands can give us that. And we're counting on public lands to protect outdoor workers and everybody affected by the climate crisis, because like I left off earlier, outdoor workers are dying and being impaired with lifelong health complications from extreme heat and breathing wildfire smoke. An investigation by NPR and Columbia Journalism found that about 400 outdoor workers died from heat exposure throughout the past 10 years alone And since 2010, Hispanics have accounted for a third of all of these heat fatalities. And so when you hear things, or if you hear news about like oil and gas drilling in Alaska, or debates about like windmill versus oil drilling off of the coasts and in our oceans, we have to connect that even the most remote instances of harming our public lands and taking these fossil fuels is targeting our communities and our outdoor workers especially.
Val, what does advocacy for water equity entail in Latinx communities?
Yeah, so when we're talking about water equity, we're talking about ensuring that Latinos have access to clean, affordable drinking water. And so what that means, so like since the 1970s, there's been a decline in terms of investments, in terms of water infrastructure across the U.S. But when we talk about the water systems that Latini, low-income, and like other communities of color have been struggling with, is that not only are they in worse conditions, but they also struggle to meet federal drinking water standards. And you also see that contamination is almost twice as high in terms of the national rate in counties where populations are over 25% Latino. And so, you know, also bringing it back to farm workers, a lot of the farm worker communities are predominantly Latino, and they are often neglected and also lack functional water and sanitation systems. So when we advocate for water equity, it means that our communities have, you know, robust plans in place to not only be bringing in, right, bottled water, which also has issues. It's extremely expensive in comparison to tap water, but highlighting the fact that, you know, it's not just taking back the tap. It's the fact that our communities have been unable to build trust within their utilities, within, you know, like, or to trust the tap water. And so there's a lot of concerns when it comes to being able to drink out of that tap, right? Like it goes beyond that. It's also ensuring that that water that's coming out of the tap is clean and is like usable for not just drinking, but also for hygiene and sanitation. And so, you know, in terms of going into short-term solutions that could look in terms advocating for state revolving funds, which are imperfect, but they're the solution that we have right now. And, you know, we advocate to ensure that those are accessible and equitable, but also long-term solutions could include like establishing and continuing funding for a permanent national water and sewer assistance program for these low-income communities, establishing policies that guarantee water affordability, eliminating water shutoffs when people can't afford to pay these high water bills for water that is often, you know, not safe to drink or people just have a general distrust in. And then also to ensure that we're shifting from water assistance to water affordability and to ensure that, you know, these shutoffs don't happen at all. And also, you know, just more representation for the Latino community when it comes to these federal agencies such as US EPA, but also when we're looking about like strategy building, it could also be FEMA, NOAA, other agencies where Latinos are often underrepresented when it comes to the staff at the federal level.
On the Green Latinos website, the public land and ocean page specifically mentions that Green Latino seeks to ensure that environmental assets to Latine communities are properly protected. And so we're curious about like, how does protecting the land and water protect the cultural identities of the Latina communities?
Thank you. So to start, when we conserve public lands, we don't just conserve the nature that's out there. We conserve history, and we have great opportunities to interpret the past, present, and future of the people who have been in community with a specific place over the country's history and beyond. And so, you know, that's all to say, like the national parks, the national monuments, the wild and scenic rivers, every conservation area, and those that don't have conservation designations, like wildlands throughout the West, tells a story. it probably tells many stories. And in the case of Hispanic and Latino cultures and histories, it's probably not telling the story because we're very much underrepresented in the Park Service, in the Fish and Wildlife Service, across the Bureau of Land Management, National Forest Site. It's pretty astounding, particularly coming from the, you know, from a background where, like, the way that my grandparents raised my parents and the way that my parents raised me, I was grown to like love and appreciate nature and see that we have been a part of history here in the United States for a long, 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 long time.
In terms of ocean conservation, being able to protect ocean spaces provides a context in terms of the topics that Olivia was mentioning was the cultural and historical connections that Latinos have to the land and water and ocean. And so just like in terms of, you know, some like percentages of how Latinos connect with the ocean, Azul, which is a ocean justice and ocean conservation Latina-led group, did a poll in 2002 looking at how U.S. Latinos think about the ocean space. And so what you found is that there's an overwhelming support in terms of ocean conservation. And that's because a lot of people have either talked, you know, if we're talking about like the impacts of climate change, you know, there's also this like understanding of climate change in terms of like this global level, because a lot of people may have either have families or they themselves have personally experienced the impacts of climate change and what that means for their communities and the environment around them. But we also see that they predominantly believe, so the exact percent is 86% of like U.S. Latinos believe that the government has responsibility to preserve ocean and public lands for the enjoyment of future generations as well. So they're also thinking about like what this means in the long term. And so we see that Latinos, even if in, you know, mainstream environmental movement, that might not be the perceived perception, they often break stereotypes of what it means to be, you know, quote unquote, an environmentalist. We see that 92% of people from the poll really wanted to see there'd be more efforts in terms of preventing plastic pollution. And 80% of them responded that they would support a ban of like single-use plastics, which is a major issue when it comes to ocean work. And 96% of them said that they think environmental issues like pollution and global warming are really important to them. And, you know, if we're thinking about also nuestros hispanohablantes in our community, where the poll actually also found that they were more progressive in terms of climate issues and English speaking households, where you have 72 respondents in Spanish speaking households saying that, you know, these environmental issues are important to them compared to about 51% for English speaking households. So I think when, you know, when we talk about ocean spaces, we're also thinking about those cultural ties. You know, right now, a lot of like the news and like social media cycle is focusing on Mazatlan and the cultural ties to Banda that came from that region, and how there's complaint from foreign tourists there trying to make the beaches be silent, which is like counterintuitive to all this, you know, culture and history behind the ocean space there. And though I know that's, you know, not within the US perspective, but I think that's an excellent example of how oftentimes our history gets pushed out or gets just excluded when it comes to these coastal spaces. And so I would like to mention too, like even within, you know, the time that I grew up in that farm worker community, we would go out to day, you know, on day trips to be able to visit the ocean in Monterey and in Santa Cruz. And like those were always, and so even though we didn't interact in this with the ocean in the same way that maybe other people would have, like there's still that connection and respect for the ocean and being able to see it. And I think that that's really important too, when we think about this is like coastal access and recreation and joy that people get. And being able to ensure that, you know, there's public transit, that there's access to, if, you know, if you have to drive, there's access to parking that isn't going to be expensive. And then also like affordable accommodations, because oftentimes, you know, for us, it was a 2-hour drive. You know, maybe so there are some people that just can't make that drive in a single day. And so being able to to have like affordable accommodations for you to be able to stay the night and then be able to head out in the morning also just allows for more accessible recreational use of that space and to and allow us to bring those connections of like, you know, maybe you did grow up in Mazatlán and you, or you have that strong tie to Banda, and being able to have in that space is like a reminder of home. So just as one example.
Yeah, thank you. And for our listeners, we did lose Olivia at this point. Maybe they'll be able to jump back in at some point. We'll cross our fingers and see what happens. All right. So, you know, and Val, you started to talk a little bit about this, but how have historical exclusion, oppression, and injustices shaped U.S. land and ocean management policies? Specifically, what kind of barriers have they created for members of marginalized communities? And maybe, because you all started talking about this, maybe thinking about it in terms of the health and well-being of Latine communities.
Yeah, when looking at, you know, the landscape, I think that just in general, in terms of like the environmental movement, it has predominantly centered a lot of white voices. And only very recently have we started to see a shift in terms of centering BIPOC voices, particularly, you know, when we think about Indigenous voices, when it comes to the land back movement in terms of the traditional ways of knowing Indigenous knowledge and being able to advocate for conservation, that as, you know, the original stewards of the land and reverting back to some of these practices. So what comes to mind, you know, just because of where I grew up in California and thinking about prescribed burning and the integration of, for a while, there was a complete ban in terms of the prescribed burning, which a lot of Indigenous groups within, you know, the Sierra Nevadas would do, particularly, you know, around like Yosemite and the Sequoia National Park. And within the last couple of decades is when prescribed burnings became more of a practice. And I know that even within the last decade or so, Indigenous groups have started to be engaged in when it comes to these sorts of practices and understanding like how important that was to ensure that there wasn't like leaf litter on the ground, because then that exasperated wildfires, for as one example. And so those are hard lessons, but you know, like I am very happy to see that our voices are continued to be amplified in the public land and ocean spaces. You know, within the work that I do in terms of ocean work, we are actually, Green Latinos is part of a group called the Ocean Equity Collective, which is a collective of BIPOC-led groups, all focused on ocean conservation and stewardship. And that includes Indigenous folks, and it includes Black and Latinos. And so what we have done is come together and we move at the speed of trust in terms of like what our priorities are when it comes to ocean conservation, but also what are some insights and perspectives that our communities could bring together to provide resources for, you know, federal agencies and maybe other big greens or predominantly white environmental groups to be able to understand what it means to when we're thinking about ocean conservation that is inclusive of the BIPOC community. And so we're actually able to release a language guide that focused on providing some definitions of important words that are often used in the ocean conservation space, but and phrases, and then also like just some general practice guides of like what to do and what not to do. For example, when you're speaking about community engagement, are you amplifying the community's voice, or are you quote unquote empowering them, right? Like, so it's like, what does empowering really mean? Rather than using that word, right, it's like we are having them be like key decision makers in this project, right? We are amplifying their needs and their insights in terms of what these solutions look like when it comes to climate resiliency and implementing them. And so that is readily available for anyone who's interested in like learning more about the language guide. And we are in the process of releasing another one, which is about community engagement in particular when it comes to BIPOC communities, and just like some key questions and insights that may be considered when you're thinking about a project or some sort of campaign or initiative that you would like to engage a community with, and how you could do it in a way that's not extractive, but actually is bringing forth that community in a way that, you know, they're a true partner in the outcomes of that. But going into policy, I think it just ties in terms of like not just the management practices, but I think that there are pushes for ensuring that these are more equitable and that they're not being, you know, extractive or removing, whether it's Indigenous communities or Black and Brown communities away from spaces, but actually being able to make them more accessible.
Val, within that process of elevating and amplifying the stories of Latina people, Latina leaders in the front lines of conservation and environmentalism, right? What is the role of storytelling in protecting these communities, specifically when it comes to defending, protecting, and restoring public landscape and open ocean and water access?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think storytelling is a really important, crucial part to it. As I have alluded to before, you know, the Latino community may not be engaging in, you know, conservation in the same way that mainstream environmental movement may be seeing as the quote unquote way to do it. And I think that storytelling provides an avenue for the Latina community to really think about like not just the work that they're doing and also seeing representation of other Latina people in that conservation space, but to ensure to also show that, you know, you can be a conservationist, an environmentalist, you know, whatever sort of like green identity, I will just, you know, use that as a umbrella term, like that you would want to be. And it doesn't have to look, you know, a certain way because, you know, this is right, a prescribed way of doing environmentalism the correct way. And so I think that that storytelling aspect also brings forth, you know, like some of the barriers that, you know, the previous question kind of asked about. It's like, some people will take non-traditional ways to go to school. Some people like maybe didn't receive a degree, but they are, you know, based in a community that is very like passionate about a specific topic. So like, you know, if the community lives near the coast, for example, like they may be like in the insights of like what the off season looks like, what it means to be around that community year round, and like what some of those responses may be. And I think that's really important as well to think about, like, you know, the environmentalist may be, you know, someone who is brown or black, and they're doing hard work. And oftentimes the reality is that a lot of like media doesn't cover their efforts. And so I think that the storytelling piece, and here at, you know, within Green Latinos, like we, within the Public Land and Ocean Colectivo, we always try to highlight our, like in our newsletter, a member or a partner who's doing great work and who is just another example of like, this is a way that you can engage in. It's not the way, like it's just one of many ways that you as a, you know, a Green Latinos member or partner can help fight the fight against, you know, for, you know, against oppression and fight towards environmental liberation. And it requires all of us, you know, like every step that you take in doing that is another step towards a win, if not, you know, a win on its own. So I think that storytelling helps in terms of that narrative shift of like what it means to be an environmentalist, and also to demonstrate that it's better to show up and fight imperfectly than, you know, this misperception of like, you need to be the perfect environmentalist or, you know, have a zero net carbon footprint, which we know is like, that's just BP Oil's spiel to revert responsibility. But like, you know, so it's just like, yeah, there's lots of ways that you can show up, and we need everyone. So every small thing is always a win.
Yeah. So we have a question about infrastructure and funding, right? And so the question is, in what ways does Green Latinos work, the work you do, contribute to addressing these challenges, and specific about aging infrastructure and the decrease of federal funding regarding clean water, in particular in low-income communities?
Yeah. So we We are definitely strong advocates, as I mentioned, in terms of ensuring that that infrastructure is maintained. I know that right now with, you know, the IRA and the Build Back Better plans, like there's a lot of money that's going forward in terms of ensuring that infrastructure is being maintained. So within Green Latinos, what we're trying to do is build a lot of capacity in within the Latino community to be able to access these types of funding. And so we have a couple of mechanisms in place. There is a, you know, like Justice 40 and those initiatives and making sure that climate vulnerable communities are being able to access funds for climate resiliency purposes. And that includes, right, like infrastructure. We do have a group called Colaborativo 40, which is focused on ensuring that the Latino community is being able to access those funds. But also what we're doing is, you know, with the rollout of all these initiatives, we've been able to build some webinars to ensure that there are guidance to engaging in that grant application process. Because before, you know, you even start to be able to build it, you need to be able to have those funds. And one of the large barriers is, you know, being able to have the capacity, not just in terms of grant writing, but also, you know, understanding like what a competitive grant may look like. And so we have a couple of staff members who focus on ensuring that there's a lot of support in terms of like connecting people, whether that's to information of like, how do I start this application process? For example, like the one that we had in December was for the community chain grant, but also how does Green Latinos act as a intermediary in terms of being able to provide funding? So this is tangential to infrastructure, but it is related. So right now, Green Latinos did receive $2.65 million in grants to be redistributed back to the Latino community. And so these are specifically for communities in Los Angeles, Albuquerque, and Chicago. And those are focused on urban greening and tree planting. And so this is more in terms of like green infrastructure. But as we mentioned, in terms of like heat, one of the solutions when it comes to urban heating is to be able to ensure that you're planting more trees and the urban parks have more green space available. And so that initiative, which we're really excited about, is part of a broader program that's called Greening America Cities Initiative, and it's funded by the Bezos Earth Fund. But that's just like one way in which like Green Latinos is directly being able to give back to the communities and have those communities drive what those solutions look like. And so really excited about that. And we're hoping that we can see more of those types of efforts. The last thing that I would also mention is we have a Justicia y Equidad Fund. And so those are small scale grants for communities, community groups to be able to build capacity in terms of their community-based organizations and like the initiatives that they're doing. And so we're really excited about that because a lot of the ones that that apply are also focused in terms of water and water and ocean conservation. And so we hope to see that programs continue as we continue to, you know, move forward. I know that there is like some concern when it comes to like, you know, what's going to happen when the funding runs out. If the, you know, this is an election year, like, are these funds going to continue? And so what we're hoping for is that we continue to be able to be a resource and advocate for a continuation of these funds and to ensure that the Latino community continues to have resources and access to strong infrastructure for affordable and clean drinking water and clean parks and, you know, public lands.
So, you know, you're talking here about a funding that you're receiving and outreach that Green Latinos does. Are there any other active outreach initiatives that the organization has engaged in that you'd like to share with our listeners? And honestly, the best way that like our listeners could themselves participate in public land and water equity conservation?
Yeah. So as I have mentioned, Olivia and I, as well as two other staff members in Green Latinos, we run the Public Land and Ocean Colectivo. And so that is just a collective of folks that are interested in specifically public land and ocean conservation. And we hold webinars and also provide resources related to ongoing, you know, policy insights that are happening on the Hill. And so we try to engage our colectivo in that way. And we also have some calls to action of, you know, if you're interested in protecting marine protected areas or historical sites, like we try to keep everyone up to date in terms of those. And we also host quarterly encuentros, which are webinars, and we bring forth speakers and a certain topic. The most recent one was the one that Public Lands had, which focused on historical conservation sites that and the importance of ensuring that the Latino history is maintained within those sites and the efforts that groups are working in towards that. And then we also do ocean themed ones. One that is that was a little bit more specific to wetlands was in March during because in March is National Wetland Day. And so we've brought in a coastal wetland expert and a inland wetland expert. And so we talked about the kinship in terms of ocean and the wetland space. And so that was really exciting. The other thing, if people are interested, we are looking for a co-chair for the colectivo. So like, if you want to be like, not just a member, but like being involved in terms of like connecting people, shameless plug, but
no, but do like, it. That's what this no, is please. For.
Go for it.
yeah. But if you know, we are looking for someone who wants to be engaged. And so, you know, if that's not even like within the capacity of like making connections, like we do offer a stipend. So there's also like, for being engaged within the colectivo. So we try to ensure that, you know, we're compensating people for their time as well. And so the other thing in terms of like, okay, well, maybe virtual isn't my jam. I want to do things in person. We do host encuentros in person. And so, for example, for the Urban Greening Initiative that I had mentioned, there's an encuentro today in Los Angeles. And so we usually, whenever we have some sort of like staff convening, because as I mentioned, we're a national organization, we also try to have some sort of an encuentro related to that, so that we're not just, you know, showing up in a community, but we're also being able to connect with that community and be able to build those relationships there. With the urban greening initiatives, those help in terms of like having more localized ones, but we do have encuentros whenever, you know, the staff convenes. And then lastly, we do have a national summit that's going to be coming up, and that'll be May 7th through 10th, and that'll be in Puerto Rico. And that's also, you know, an in-person convening for people to have the opportunity to meet. And we're trying to keep them at an annual basis. You know, mm-hmm. after the pandemic is still ongoing, but you know, after a few years from after the peak of the pandemic, they're coming back. So this will be the second one post COVID-19. So.
Well, Val, thank you so much for joining us. And please, you know, thank Olivia for us as well. We're sorry that they got cut off the call, but I know we're really grateful that they were able to join us in any capacity today. We definitely learned a lot, and there's a lot of things we can share with our listeners, our students as well. And, you know, you mentioned a lot of projects and a lot of ways that people can be active in Green Latinos and like beyond Green Latinos as well. Is there anything else that you would like to mention before we wrap up, and specifically maybe letting us know where listeners can find the work that Green Latinos does and the other organizations that you were a part of?
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, I would just like to mention, like, if you're interested, like, please become a member. It's free. You can go to our website, greenlatinos.org, and to find more information on terms of like the colectivos. One of the things I didn't mention was also the Water Equity Colectivo. And that's more focused on like infrastructure. And we do a similar thing where we have webinars and listserv for people to understand. And we also try to post out, you know, career opportunities when we come across them, just because we want to ensure that if people are interested in building a career in the environmental or green space, like that they have an opportunity to do so. And then, yeah, in terms of social media, it's @Green Latinos. And like I mentioned, the website is greenlatinos.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
So, Rebecca, what were your takeaways from the conversation?
Well, first, it was unfortunate that a lot of Olivia's answers were cut out and that they weren't able to fully participate.
True that.
But I appreciate that Val added to the conversation for them both. From what we did hear from Olivia, it seems that there was some interesting overlap between their answers and what we learned from Jennifer last month. Specifically when it comes to Latina communities and outdoor laborers, like farm workers, construction, etc. One thing that stood out to me was what Val had to say about engaging in inclusive conservation practices, specifically those that amplify BIPOC voices, and making sure that they're key decision makers in the process of creating and establishing policies. And specifically in terms of policies, it really seems like Green Latinos is, as an organization, is pretty proactive in that area. Not only do they have community engaged outreach and events, but they have people that focus on specifically on speaking with policymakers and advocating for and taking action in providing equity to Latina communities when it comes to water equity and the use of public land. So it's like hitting the community, but also like aiming at the policymakers as well.
Yeah, I also appreciated Ball's comment, supported with numbers, that Latinas want climate actions. They say that climate crisis is part of Latinas' most pressing concerns, politically speaking, but also on a daily basis. A vital thing discussed is that climate action requires multiple solutions and embodiments, from representation in conservation institutions at the federal level to ground literacy programs to more direct hands-on work in parks, urban areas, and ocean communities. The importance of storytelling practices, as you mentioned, that are not extractive was a takeaway for me as well, and the centering of indigenous and people of color voices. I love the invitation to think about how a green identity looks different in every person, and there are multiple and non-traditional ways to show up in ecologically conscious work.
All right, everyone, thanks for joining us for this episode. Remember, you too could share your thoughts with us. You can always reach out to us on social media or by email.
Follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at LatinXvisions. Our email address is latinxvisions@gmail.com, and we love to include your thoughts in a future episode.
Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Share us with your friends and family. Subscribe and leave a 5-star review to help us with that pesky algorithm. And stay tuned for this summer when we'll release at least one or two bonus episodes from our students, as well as an episode from my last visit to New York Comic Con, where I spoke on a panel.
All right, estamos a la escucha.
Dale, until next season.